The uniforms that arrived from the tailor were amazingly comfortable, made from some weave of cotton and dross silk that were as soft as they were strong. Ediard hadn't expected that. Unlike the dress uniform which Christabel had given him, these were all for everyday use. They lacked the sheer gaudiness of militia uniforms, but the tailor had somehow contrived to make them a lot more glamorous than the ones Ediard had bought from the regular constable's supplier. Platinum buttons shone brighter than Dinlay's aging, over-polished silver ones. The cut was subtly different, making him look sharp and smart, the kind of tunic a member of the nobility would wear if they could ever lower themselves to sign on at a station. And the shirts made mountaintop snow look grey by comparison. The tailor even supplied a special mix of soap flakes for the G-chimps to use, so as not to sully that purity. And as for the knee-high boots, space between the nebulas wasn't that black, nor did it possess such luster. The first morning he put one on, Ediard stood nervously in front of his maisonette's mirror and looked at the figure he cut. No way could he stop the prideful smile from lifting his lips. Dashing, he decided. Yes, very dashing. The long weather cloak helped, held by an emerald-encrusted brooch round his neck, which he was trying to pin into place one-handed. His third hand ruffled it, and he admired the swirl it made around him. Nice touch. He practiced the ruffle again, making the fabric flare out and undulate in slow motion. Perhaps it could become his signature. At night, he would brighten the city's orange lights to silhouette himself as he emerged from nowhere to bear down formidably on criminals, cloaks swirling like angry smoke behind him. At such an impressive sight, the fight would go out of them, and they'd abandon their wrongdoing, sinking to their knees in contrition. Okay, then. Yow! The brooch pin jabbed into his fumbling thumb. Ediard shook it, then sucked the drop of blood away. Lady Dam. All right, so the image needs a bit of work. He fixed the brooch in place, settled the hat on his head, and ran a finger along the rim, ending in a salute to himself. Now that's what I call an officer of the city. Maxon called it something else entirely as Ediard strode purposefully into their small hall at Jeevan Station. Young Felax dropped his jaw in astonishment as Ediard walked past the bench he was sitting at. A cheeky chorus of wolf whistles echoed round the small hall. "Happy to see you're not abandoning your roots," Cancine sniped. Ediard unclipped the brooch and removed his weather cloak with a flourish. "Anyone else jealous?" "I'm so glad you taught us concealment," Boyd grunted, "because there's no way I'm walking down a street next to that." Dinlay glared at him for the indiscretion. "You look very smart," he said. "People have expectations from us now. It's right that you should look the part." "Thank you," Ediard acknowledged. He looked round the hall. There were 10 constables sitting at the tables now, men he trusted implicitly, reading through reports. The way files were building up, they'd soon have to contract the Guild of Clerks to keep track of it all, Ediard thought ruefully. 72 of them now, Doral said. "That's good," Ediard acknowledged. Most of the files in the hall were those on the excluded, which were still being added to. But his team had been going through them and assessing the reports from stations across the city, along with the priceless information coming in through Chariao and his network of merchants and traders. Ediard's old notes from his days spying on the House of Blue Petals were also examined keenly. Slowly and surely, they were identifying the senior echelons of the gangs. The leadership rarely met in person, so there was no hard evidence actually tying them together in any criminal act. But the way they collaborated and respected each other's territories meant that they knew each other, that they were organized along formal lines. In fact, it was intriguingly like a mirror to the way which the interests of the established nobility locked together. Ediard was still a little irked that they hadn't proved a connection between the gangs and the more disreputable aristocratic families, such as the Gilmornes, for example. "Can't we just go and arrest them?" Boyd whined. "Surely 72 is enough. And Boate is still having to appear in the financial court each day." Ediard pulled a face. "I'd like it to be 100, he said. There was something about the number which was impressive. It would show Macathran's citizens how they were making huge inroads against the gangs, that it wasn't just exclusion warrants and the promises of the mayoral candidates they were deploying against the gangs. The idea wasn't to get convictions. Hediard knew he didn't have enough evidence for that. But a little-known clause in the articles of arrest meant that if a constable swore there were grounds for suspicion that the detainee was involved in illegal activity, they could be held for 22 days without charges being filed. The 22 days were supposed to allow the constables enough time to gather evidence and interview all concerned. Hediard reasoned that with the entire leadership, or as many as he could reasonably identify, taken off the streets and held incommunicado for half a month, the gang's ordinary street soldiers would be completely lost. A body without a head, as Maxon had summed it up. If gang resistance crumbled, as Hediard hoped, liberating people from the prospect of it all coming back at the end of the 22 days would be a colossal argument in Finnerton's favor to bring about the banishment. Finnerton was also planning to introduce emergency legislation to the Grand Council as soon as the arrests began, extending the detention period to a full month. 44 days would take them past the election. It was slightly underhand, Hediard thought, but then this was Macathran. He wasn't about to change it overnight. He sat down at the table he used and gave the neat grey cardboard folders a dispirited look. No matter how hard they worked or how much he delegated, the paperwork never got any smaller. "Something more for you to read?" Dinlay said. Hediard looked up to see his friends clustered together, smiling as Dinlay held out a small red book. "A gift from all of us," Cansine said. Hediard took the book. It was very slim. Small gold-leaf lettering on the front read, "A Gentleman's Guide to Marriage." "Thank you," he said, genuinely grateful. "What does it say about the stagnate?" Maxon said, caught himself, threw Cansine a panicked look. "I mean, friend's night," he corrected. She just groaned weakly. Hediard flicked through the pages. "An evening may justifiably be set aside for a fellow to bid his male acquaintances farewell, in the full knowledge that his bachelor ways are about to end. This should be a tasteful evening, revisiting those places, retaining fond memories, and sampling their delights for the last time." "I don't want another night at Ollivan's Eagle," Dinlay protested. "This is supposed to be special." "We could start at the Rakus restaurant in Abad, the one we went to after graduation," Cansine said. Hediard was about to agree, but Salrana had been with them that day. "Maybe a different one," he said.
"There's a theatre in Fiacre I know of," Boyd said breathlessly. "The dancers take their clothes off as they dance."
"Do they?" Hediard asked. Cansine deliberately focused on a point just above Ediard's head, her jaw set firm. "That's not reliving the past," Hediard conceded.
"We'll start off at the dog track in Andromeda, then make our way through some of the classy taverns in Lilylight," Maxon said. "There are plenty of good restaurants and theatres there, so we can make our choices on the night."
"Excellent idea," Cansine said. "Julian has to get the vote through council first," Hediard complained.
"It's considered bad form to vote against a consent bill," Dinlay said. "There hasn't been a nay vote for over 300 years.
"Really? I didn't know that."
"We know," they said in unison.
Hediard was supposed to spend the evening choosing the suit to wear at the charity ball thrown by the district master of Nighthouse. Due in a fortnight's time, it was given every year to raise funds for city hospitals. Christabel had accepted his excuse that there was just some constable work which had to be done at night.
"Be careful,"
she told him, which almost made him feel guilty. Almost. It was certainly the first time Hediard had ever been grateful to Boate. But the gang lord had arranged a meeting with several others on their 100 list. A get-together of that magnitude couldn't be ignored. As dusk fell, he led the squad out of the station. All of them were immediately aware of the 3 G-Eagles overhead, and a couple of small G-Dogs loitering down the street. It had been a while since the gangs had used actual people to spy on their comings and goings from the constable station. "I want to try something," he told the others. "We're not going to use the tunnels for a while." They followed him over Marble Canal Bridge into Droop, where the streets grew narrow and the buildings tall. The G-Eagles kept level with them, drifting and soaring on the night air.
"I've been reading your book,"
Ediard said. Apparently, after marriage, I shouldn't complain to Christabel about events relating to managing my estate if they go poorly.
Yeah, I always avoid that when I'm with Soraya, Boyd said. It's for the best.
Nor should I be querulous about the proportion of the household budget spent on her wardrobe. Apparently it's her duty to always look her best for me and support me in public.
Quite right, Kanzine said.
And I must not feel inadequate if I cede an argument to her.
This has to have been written by a woman, Dinley pronounced.
It was already dark at the foot of the buildings when they walked into Moslet Avenue, little more than a deep crevice between walls 6 stories high. Small vaulting tube bridges linked the 2 sets of buildings, with slender orange light slits on their underside shining a weak orange glow down onto the pavement. The alley was a series of sharp corners, which restricted far sight, while its narrow width made anyone following them highly conspicuous. Precisely the kind of place that usually provided Ediard with excellent cover while he vanished down into the tunnels below. He ordered the orange light strips on the bridges to dim down, turning the darkness to a claustrophobic force. A sweep round with his farsight showed him they were alone as they went round the first corner. Then he followed that up with a more subtle look, using the technique Finnerton had gifted him. Someone was sneaking into the alley, registering in his mind as a grey swirl, like a small bubble of fog. At the core was the outline of a man.
Keep going, he told his friends. We need to hurry.
They started to jog forwards. Ediard observed the figure behind them quicken his pace.
Okay, stop here, he ordered as they went round the second corner.
They were directly under one of the small bridges, invisible to the G-Eagles above. The concealed pursuer hurried round the corner, to see the squad huddled together as if performing some illegal act. Ediard's arm came up, pointing at him, cloak swirling to follow the move. The narrow alley was suddenly drenched in brilliant white light. A terrific bang ricocheted off the confining walls. Ediard's miniature thunderbolt struck the figure square in his chest. He was flung backwards to sprawl on the ground, concealment vanishing in the blink of an eye.
Great lady! Dinley gulped.
Ediard was watching the figure keenly. The man was twitching but making no attempt to get up. Farsight revealed he was still alive, his thoughts chasing an agitated sleep pattern. The thunderbolt must have knocked him unconscious, though his heart was still pumping wildly and not entirely regular. His thick leather jacket was smoking from a burn spot where the discharge had struck.
Take care of the G-Eagles, Ediard told Kanzine, as his third hand lifted the inert figure and drew him towards the squad.
The birds would have witnessed the flash, he couldn't help that, but they would have been dazzled. Their owners still wouldn't know what was going on in the alley. Once Kanzine had confused the already flustered Genistars overhead, Ediard asked the city to let him into the drain tunnel below the street. The squad sank down, taking their captive with them. Once they were safe below the surface, Ediard examined the man his third hand was still holding above the trickle of water. He was plain enough, probably in his late 40s, with dark curly hair and a small, neatly trimmed beard.
Anyone know him? Ediard asked.
I don't remember him from any of our lists, Dinley said.
Maxim let out a pained sigh.
He won't be. Look at how he's dressed.
Ediard gave the unconscious man a closer look. The clothes were simple, a black leather jacket worn over an indigo shirt and beige suede trousers, ankle-length boots with discreet silver hooks for the laces, the kind of garb that could be worn anywhere in Macathran without drawing undue attention. However, these days Ediard was familiar enough with the city's tailors to know quality when he saw it.
Expensive, he said.
Certainly not cheap, Maxon said. So we know he's not from the gangs, not directly.
The families?
Maxon's face produced a pained expression.
Again, nothing you could ever prove, not that he'll tell us anything.
What then? Boyd asked. Come on, you obviously know something.
Look exactly where we are and how we got here, Maxon said, with the kind of serious level voice that was unusual for him.
And that blast of light you knocked him out with, Ediard, that's something new. There's a rumour that your maisonette is different. A fall off a tower can't kill you. Small wonder the families are extremely interested in you.
The families can throw light like that,
Hedyard said defensively. I just have greater strength.
No, it's more than just strength. Can anyone else see souls? Can they talk to the city itself? Nobody can. You stand above us, Water Walker. A long way above.
So, Dinlay said, we've always known Hedyard is far more talented than the rest of us put together.
This goes way beyond psychic talent.
Maxon gave Hedyard a level stare.
You frighten people, Water Walker. Even I'm nervous of you, and I know you better than most in this city. I don't think you'll abuse the power you have. But face it, what's to stop you? That's why you're drawing this kind of attention.
I would never...
Hedyard broke off, appealing to his friends.
I want the city to work, to be a home we can all depend on, a place where everyone can be safe. You know that. That's why you're helping me. Isn't it?
He asked, aghast that they might not share his ambition.
Yes, Kansine assured him, but you have to admit, Maxon has a point. Not only have you got your talent, but you're popular as well. I bet if you stood for mayor, you'd get a sizable amount of the votes.
I don't want to. I support Finneton.
I know that, she told him. The point is the Grand families see how much support you have, and they know you want to instigate change.
Change, for them, a return to more democratic rule, the introduction of accountability, will diminish their power, and Lady help them their wealth, too. That's what the city's entire political structure is geared around, preserving and expanding their estates. If you wipe out the gangs, you'll go after them next. And the way they've distorted and abused Ra's constitution, that's inevitable.
Some people say you are Ra, Boyd said.
He shrugged. It's true. I'm often asked. They think you've come back from heart to restore the city to the haven it was in the beginning. The gangs and the bandits we're plagued with right now, that's the kind of chaos Ra led his followers away from.
Oh, dear lady,
Hedyard gave Dinlay a desperate look.
People have asked me, too,
Dinlay said apologetically. But I know you're not going to declare yourself emperor. That's stupid. They'd never say that if they knew you properly. Hedyard felt incredibly weary. After everything he'd done, all he'd endured, to find he had created a huge source of mistrust and suspicion was a hideous revelation.
I just want people to be safe, he cried. I want the killing to stop. I want the fear to end. I want people to know their leaders and constables will protect them.
Kansine put her arm around his shoulder. I think that's what disturbs the families most of all. They can't believe someone with your strength can be honest. But you are. And I will stand by you to the end because of that.
Me too, Dinlay said.
I trust you, Hedyard, Boyd said.
They all turned to Maxon.
Heh, goes without saying.
Say it anyway, Kansine said.
I'm with you.
Thank you.
But you've got to admit, everything you can do, it's way beyond anything Quarentia has seen before, and I include Ra in that, blasphemy or not.
Yeah,
Hedyard admitted sheepishly.
So, Dinlay queried, are you Ra?
No.
So why you? Maxon asked. You must be something special.
Really, I'm not.
You were chosen, Kansine said.
We know everything the lady says in her scriptures is true. You showed us Che's soul, and haven't you got to love the irony in that, him of all people? So if we have souls, and Odin see is the path to the heart, there's a lot more to this universe than we know.
Chosen? Hedyard repeated dumbly.
I don't know by who or by what. But there's no way you, with all your abilities, came forth at a time like this purely by chance. The heart, or our ancestors, are speaking to us through you.
Maybe not them, Hedyard said, thinking of his dreams. But I can hardly deny what I can do, whoever gave me the gift. And I promise you, I'll do what I think is right with it. And if any of you disagree, then for the lady's sake tell me.
He looked down at their unconscious captive.
Which brings us back to him. Who is he?
The families have their own methods of maintaining order in the city, Maxon said. After all, they could hardly rely on the constables now, could they? Not before the Water Walker came along.
Dinlay bridled. The constables have always brought law and order to Macathran. We were established by Ra himself.
Ra allowed district masters to police their districts, Maxon replied equitably. Independent city-wide constables weren't introduced until a lot later.
Ediard held up a hand to silence a glowering Dinlay. You're saying there's another police force in Macathran?
Maxon shook his head. That's too strong a word. The true grand families are as old as the city. As soon as they established themselves, they sought methods of consolidating their interests. Families have their own guards, for instance. They also have clerks, lawyers, doctors, a long list of employees to cover every requirement. Well, there are also people who look after political interests, too, which is a very broad-ranging term. You've seen the grandest families are not subject to intimidation by the gangs. Their estates are immune. Why is that?
Because they work with them? Ediard asked.
No, you're thinking too literally. There is an understanding. Nothing formal. Nobody ever sat round a table and thrashed out boundaries. But the families take care of themselves at every level. If a gang was ever stupid or arrogant enough to overstep the mark, then certain members of the family would put a stop to the violation straight away, and in a fashion the gangs would comprehend.
But, Manatha, Ediard said.
Yeah, the biggest shock to hit this city since our day at Birmingham Pool. I hate to see it, but cause and effect.
Are you one of them? Dinlay asked. One of these family agents?
No.
You seem to know a lot about them.
Actually, I don't. One of my father's cousins hinted a couple of times that there was a group of relatives that might be interested in welcoming me as an associate. That was as far as it ever got. Father died and, well, you all know how my family treated mother and myself after that.
It makes a lot of sense, Ediard said, except I think it's more than a vague accord as far as some families are concerned. I know from personal experience that the Gilmornes are heavily involved with Boate's organization.
Maxon nodded down at the man Ediard's third hand was still holding. There have been two well-executed attempts to get rid of you. They won't stop now, especially as your abilities still seem to be growing.
Ediard thought back to that last conversation with Ival.
You may be right, in which case we're not leading events the way we thought we were.
Welcome to Macathran, Maxon said, where it's always about politics.
Good. You're starting to understand.
Ediard inhaled through his nostrils.
So what do we do about our friend here?
The G-Eagles have shown the family agents that you possess their lightning trick, Cancine said, and you can plainly see through concealment now. The next time they come after you, it's going to be with everything they've got.
That didn't answer my question.
Why? What are you planning on doing with him?
I don't know. I just disabled him because I had to.
He won't crack under interrogation, Maxon said. He has too much faith in his own kind. That doesn't leave us with a lot of options.
There's a place I can put him where there is no way out, Ediard said, wondering if Maxon was testing him.
That will serve until we can decide what to do.
Sounds good.
When Ediard rejected Finnerton's offer of an apprenticeship to the city's Eggshapers Guild, he'd done so in the conviction that his skill was for any of the practitioners in the Blue Tower. Now, looking at the tiny G-Mouse nestling in his hand, he knew how conceited he'd been that day when he'd made his life-changing decision. The little creature was no bigger than the length of his fingers, its dark pelt as soft as any terrestrial kitten, and the three curving talons extended from each twig-like leg were sharp and hard, enabling it to scamper vertically up most of the walls in the city. But its head was the true marvel, sprouting long ears that could hear a pin drop within 30 yards, while the eyes were miniatures of those indigo-tinged orbs belonging to G-Eagles, allowing it to see clearly in the dead of night. Finnerton had handed it over with a little smirk of satisfaction.
At least you'll appreciate my efforts. Kindly look after my creation with care.
Yes, sir, Ediard had said reverentially, as he gingerly held the G-Mouse up, automatically soothing its agitated mind with balmy thoughts. Little eyes regarded him passively, and a sliver of trust manifested behind them.
Ediard smiled back.
Ah, what an apprentice you would have made, Finnerton said wistfully.
What's its lifetime?
Sadly, no more than a week.
Ediard felt a pang of sympathy, but he understood how that was so. He'd never seen a genistar this small before, and their lifespan was always proportional to size. His admiration for the Grand Master's ability rose considerably. He had no idea how to go about sculpting such a thing. For a start, it was almost smaller than a 2-week G-Dog embryo, which led to some interesting hatching questions. Akeem had always said that a standard G-Cat was the smallest possible genistar. When Ediard and the squad arrived underneath the house in Sampaloc that Boate was holding court in, he'd taken the little thing from his pocket and held it aloft. The city lifted it up from the tunnel to the lower cellar. Ediard long talked into its mind, carefully directing it under the cellar door and up the stairs to the mid-cellar. Its claws had to scrape at the hard city substance, finding minute crinkles to grip as it hauled itself up every curving shelf. There were two guards standing in the short, gloomy corridor above the stairs, both of them with pistols tucked into their belts. Neither of them noticed the G-Mouse scurrying past, nor the man who was wrapped in concealment that Ediard perceived standing just inside the door. Boate was already in the room with 8 other ganglords. They sat around a big old table with bottles of wine and beer opened before them. The G-Mouse squeezed behind a tall cupboard in the corner and scaled the ancient wood silently, emerging onto the top where someone had left a set of aged china crockery. From there it gifted Ediard its sharp sight and accompanying sound of the angry voices. Ediard shared the perception with the squad as they leaned against the tunnel wall far below the cellar floor.
"That's Gormat and Edsing," Dinlay said, "and that's Jorwell. He shaved his beard off, look."
"Are you sure?" Kansine asked.
"Yes."
"He's right," Boyd said. "No one has reported seeing him for a couple of weeks, that's why. He's a smart one, that."
"I know Hulwith and Coys," Maxon said, "but I don't recognize the others."
2 more men arrived, giving Boate and the others a curt greeting.
"So why are we here?" Joawell asked.
"Because we're hurting," Boate said. "For all we tell our men how everything is all right, that bastard Waterwalker is shutting us down one street at a time."
"I don't need to be told that," one of the unknowns said. 30 years I lived in my house, then some child constable comes along waving that lady-fucking exclusion warrant in my face. It was all I could do not to shoot the smug little shit on sight. 30 years.
"It's going to get worse," Boate said. "He's planning to arrest us all."
"There aren't that many jails."
"Not the men, just us. He's making a list. There's going to be 100 of us on it."
"Shit," Maxon grunted. "How did he find that out?"
Ediard shrugged. He wasn't surprised.
"Arrest us for what?" Coys demanded. "I've barely made enough to feed myself this year.
3 of my boys have gone and got themselves jobs in theatres for the lady's sake."
"For nothing," Boate said. "He's not going to charge us. Just hold us."
"What's the fucking point?"
"Because he can hold us for 22 days. That's the law."
22 days?
"Leading up to the election," Boate said significantly. "Without us, he thinks our men will fall apart."
"Scum fucking bastard, we should slit his throat."
"No, slit his girl's throat and make him watch, then burn him alive. That's what we did to that grocer in Zelda. Didn't have no trouble from the shopkeepers after that."
"Waterwalker's right," Edsing said. "Without us to hold it together, we'll be left with nothing."
"Less than that," Boate told them. "If Finnerton wins, we'll be thrown out of Mekathren."
"Then what are we going to do about it?" Halwith shouted. "He can't win. This is Mekathren."
"There have been several attempts to kill and ruin him, yet he still walks the streets unharmed. He has powers we don't."
"Are you saying he is Ra?" Edsing asked. "That's the talk wherever I go."
"Stupid superstition. He is an orphan from Rulan province, nothing more. I know this is true. His strength, though, is formidable."
They say the Pythia favours him.
I don't give a fuck what the Pythia favours. Our problem is not spiritual, it's very real. We are going to jail, and then we are going to be exiled to some lady-forsaken island for the rest of our lives.
Halwith's fist smashed down on the table.
We get it. Now tell us what we have to do.
Fight him, every one of us. That's all we have left. When they come to carry us off to the cells, we fight. Because if we don't, our life is over. We shoot every constable, burn every warehouse, sink the gondolas and the ships in the port. We show Macathran that we are just as strong as the Water Walker and far more deadly.
But we cannot stand against him, Coy said. They threw him off the top of a tower and he flew. Bullets are useless. I was there that night in the House of Blue Petals when your brother ambushed him. He's immortal.
Lady, maybe he is Ra.
The next one of you says that, I will slit your throat, Boate said. This is part of his strength, to cast doubt among us. Yes, he is strong, but he is one.
One!
While he comes for me, 1,000 of us will rampage across the city. He cannot stop us all. That is our strength. And when they see what their precious Water Walker has kindled, the people of this city will howl for his blood. It is he who will suffer banishment, and we will party in the Culverit Mansion that night. Now you will go home, and you will arm yourselves, and you will select targets, and when him and that squad of his knocks on our door, you will open the gates of Honius to them.
The squad took their usual table in Ollivan's Eagle. They sat staring at their beer glasses, saying nothing, morose thoughts leaking through impoverished shields.
Do you think they'll do it? Dinlay asked.
Most likely, Cancine said. We've pushed them back and back, hurt them just like Boate said.
What have they got to lose?
We just have to snatch them quickly and quietly, Boyd said.
100 separate arrests, Cancine said. Remember our raid on the fisherman's warehouse? Most of the city knew about it half a day early. Boate has been clever. He's priming them ready. It'll take one arrest to kick the whole thing off.
Then we do it tomorrow at first light, Dinlay said. They're not organized yet. There were only 10 of them there. Boate's orders won't have got any further tonight. We grab him first, then get the other district stations to pull in the rest of the list.
We're not ready either, Ediard said. Rushing into the arrests was the first thing he'd thought of. It'll take us at least a couple of days to organize things with the station captains.
I think it's safe to assume Boate's riot and destruction scheme won't have the support of the Grand Families, Boyd said. Maybe their agents would like to help us.
Not a chance, Maxon said in a disgusted tone. To them, we remain the problem. Without us, Boate wouldn't be planning this. We are the source.
Ediard took a deep drink of his beer. They know what we're planning, and we know what they're planning. But they don't know we know.
Dinlay growled in dismay, clasping his hands to his head.
Don't start that again.
It's our only advantage, Ediard said. We have to think how to use it.
How?
Cancine asked.
I don't know, Ediard said miserably.
Boate doesn't have a plan, Maxon said. Not really. This is instinct kicking in. And it's a good instinct, I'll admit that. If we don't make the arrests, he'll try to wreck the city and kill the constables when the council passes the banishment edict. He's got nothing left. Mass confrontation is his last shot to stay in the city. It's the only way he can make the upper council back off.
How do we turn a riot to our advantage? Boyd asked.
I don't see it. I really don't.
Ediard wished he knew how to answer, to show his friends some leadership. He'd settle for a single strategy. Instead, all he could do was stare into his beer and pray to the lady for some kind of inspiration, and she was going to have to be quick about it. The room was a simple cube measuring 10 yards to a side, with a single light circle on the ceiling. One corner had a high bed, with the same stiff spongy mattress found on every Macathran bed. A second corner had a small washing pool, where water circulated constantly. The third had a simple pedestal that served as a toilet. The fourth was empty. There was no door. Slits near the ceiling let fresh air flow through. Farsight couldn't penetrate through the walls or floor or ceiling. They were all too thick. No sound carried in.
The light circle did not respond to any command to dim or brighten. It remained constant. The room's single occupant had spent the first day walking about, examining every square inch with his farsight, sliding his fingertips over the walls, looking for cracks, some hint of the way in and out. He found nothing, nor could he long shout for help. The thickness of the walls prevented that. When he woke up to find himself in his not-too-unpleasant cell, there were three plates on the floor in the center of the room. They had bread and butter and two types of cheese, some slices of cold beef, fruit, and a rather nice apricot tart. He munched his way through the food during the day. On occasion he did a series of press-ups, then sit-ups. Several times he tried shouting to his captors. Please or insults, it made no difference. There was no reply. Eventually the light circle dimmed down to the faintest orange glow. He waited for a while, then gave in and lay on the bed. It took a long time for him to go to sleep. 8 hours later, the light strengthened. It revealed three new plates of food on the floor. Of the old ones, there was no sign. So he began his second uneventful day. At midday, Ediard slid up through the floor. The man was sitting on the bed at the time, eating some sweet green grapes. He stared in fascination at the way the floor around Ediard seemed to remain solid, his farsight examining it keenly.
Now that really is impressive, Water Walker, he said with a rueful grin, and popped another grape in his mouth.
Thank you, Ediard said. And you are?
Who I am doesn't matter.
It might to your wife or children.
Not married, thankfully. Too quick on my feet. But congratulations on your engagement. Quite a catch, young Christabel.
Why were you following us? The man glanced at his chest, fingering the scorch mark on his indigo shirt.
Just going about my business, officer. I wasn't following anyone. Someone assaulted me and I woke up in here.
Yes, that was me. Sorry about the shirt. It's a nice one. Where would I get one like that?
A coastal town called Chelston. It's north of here. Several days sailing in a strong wind.
You do understand that I won't let you out of here until I get some answers.
What happens when you don't get them? Do you try and beat them out of me?
No, of course not. You just stay here until you answer to my satisfaction. Apparently isolation is quite an effective method of encouraging cooperation.
Ediard glanced round the underground chamber which the city had converted for him. I'm not sure isolation is supposed to be quite as comfortable as this, but I'm a bit vague on the method. Sorry about that.
Asking tough questions in Macathran is usually a little different, the man admitted too casually. It normally involves blades and fire and heart squeeze and lung squeeze. Only the Water Walker could come up with an interrogation as strange as this one.
But you know it's going to work. You're already getting disturbed by the confinement, I can tell. So why don't you skip the whole unpleasant part and tell me what I need to know? Then I can let you out of here.
What exactly is here, Water Walker?
The constable station in Jeevans.
You're a poor liar.
I know. Everyone tells me I can't shield my thoughts the way you city-born can. I leave too much emotion visible.
The man popped down another grape and grinned.
You're getting better.
Really?
Have we met before?
Everyone knows you, Water Walker.
But not everyone is frightened of me.
I'm not frightened.
Your family is. Otherwise you wouldn't be following me round.
I told you I have no family. Wrong place, wrong time, that's me.
Why do they fear me?
I know nothing of such things.
But if you had to guess?
That voyage I took up to Chelston, it's a standard run for the captain. He knows the route, knows what to look out for. He sailed it all his life, as did his father before him and his father before that, and so on back to the day the ship fell from the sky. It's a route that keeps him and his family clothed and fed and comfortable. It is their life. It's a route that works. How do you think he would feel if one day a reef suddenly appeared in the water ahead of him and threatened to rip the keel off his ship?
A smart captain would know how to steer round it.
His ship is very large and extremely heavily laden. It doesn't turn easily.
I don't suppose it does. Not with people like you holding it on course.
But you never know. Those waters on the other side of the reef, they might be easy to sail in.
The man shook his head and sighed. How can anyone so naive get so far in this city?
It is a mystery I doubt even the lady can fathom.
Some say the lady has chosen me to repeat her message to this world.
How wonderful. Are you really going to claim that you are Ra reincarnated?
No, because we both know I'm not.
Ah, well, at least you're not declaring you have a divine right to wreck a society that's worked for 2,000 years. That's some comfort to me, I suppose.
I'm marrying Christabel, who is a greater part of this city than a dozen minor families like yours. Do you really think I will destroy everything her family has built? It is to be my family.
Minor families. You think attempting to anger me will cause me to slip my guard?
Does it anger you? The really great families will hardly be bothered by the return to law and order.
But you're what? Something like a fifth son of a fourth son of a third son? Your branch of the family must have been kicked out of that fabulous mansion a long time ago. Do you look at it enviously every time you walk past? Do you hear the laughter coming over the wall? And now your father is what? Some market trader with delusions of grandeur. I bet he doesn't pay all his taxes. Is that the only way you can keep paying the bills in your new little house? Is that why you only have enough coinage to dress as pretty as one of Christabel's foot servants? Is that why you joined this woeful little association of thugs, so you could fool yourself you're part of the grand families again?
Really, Walter Walker, I expected better.
But you are very young, aren't you? I remain to be convinced you have what it takes to see this to the bitter end, for it will be very bitter indeed.
As far as you are concerned, the end has already passed you by. When banishment is enacted, you will be escorted from the city. You will not return. Ever.
Unless you're claiming a time sense greater than our beloved Pythia, you cannot speak of the future. So I'll just wait here to see how it plays out. Thank you.
Ediard tilted his head on one side to regard his unnervingly suave opponent curiously. He hadn't been expecting anything quite this difficult.
Were you one of the four on the tower?
Ediard had returned to the base of the tower 3 times since he fell, examining the city's memories of that day. He'd felt the footsteps of his 4 assailants on the staircase winding up the center 3 hours before the pistol exchange, but try as he might, he simply couldn't backtrack them successfully. They came from a large crowd of worshippers attending the afternoon service at the church, several hundred people milling around together. It was too confusing to single out one set of feet. And of course, after he fell, no one knew what actually happened on the top of the tower until he regained consciousness. Even then he'd only told his friends. So no attempt had been made to apprehend the mysterious foursome when they scurried back down in the middle of the confusion and panic that raged around the base of the tower for well over an hour. The man smiled. It was a harsh expression.
When you fell, you thought it would be to your death. You didn't know you were going to live. That is our greatest concern. Who helps you, Walter Walker, and why?
The universe helps those who lead a good life. It says so right there in the Lady's Scriptures.
Answer me that one question, and I will answer all of yours.
Ediard gave a weary shake of his head. You will stay in here until you cooperate. I don't imagine it will take long. Isolation is an evil foe, and you are as isolated as it is possible to be on this world.
Do you truly believe you have time on your side?
We will see whose ally time really is. I'll be back. Eventually. He told the floor to let him through and sank away.
The financial courts were situated in the middle of Parliament House, running along the south side of First Canal. The 9 horseshoe arch bridges connecting the buildings on both sides of the water were so thick, containing whole suites of rooms, that they essentially formed a tunnel over the little canal. Because of that, light inside the courts was supplied almost entirely from the concave octagons decorating the vaulted ceilings. They might as well have been underground for all the difference the high slit windows made, looking out into the shadowed cavity beneath the bridges. The dusky lighting certainly added to the general sense of gloom pervading the 8th court when Ediard crept in quietly at the back of the semicircular chamber. It wasn't laid out like a law court. Instead, long tables were arranged in tiers, with the tax investigator at a round table at their center. Lamps were lit on the ends of each table, Jamalar oil producing pools of yellow light across the untidy stacks of paper and files. To Ediard's first glance, it was as though paper had come alive to breed faster than dragons.
There couldn't be so many accounts relating to the House of Blue Petals, but each table had at least two clerks sitting at it. They were all dressed the same, in shirts and waistcoats. Most seemed to be wearing spectacles. None were under 50. The tax inspector's waistcoat was lined with silver. Otherwise, there was no way of distinguishing between him and his fellow guild members. He would consult a page from a very large ledger and ask a question relating to income or expenditure. Then Boate's team of clerks would mutter among themselves and go through files and books before producing receipts or affidavits and offering an explanation as to how the money was spent or received. At which point the clerks retained by the mayor's inspector general would counter the claim, producing different bits of paper, or an entry in the ledger of the business concerned that was different to Boate's contention. After listening to the evidence, the inspector would write laboriously in his ledger and move on to the next question. 3 years' worth of records were subject to investigation. Every day's purchase of drinks had to be accounted for. 3 years of the House of Blue Petals buying and cleaning bed linen. 3 years of Genistar husbandry. 3 years of replacement mats behind the bar. 3 years of crockery, acquisitions and breakages and appreciation and amortization. 3 years of the girls' cosmetics and hairstyling, 3 years of hair clip acquisition, each batch meticulously recorded and queried. Boate sat at a table at the far side of the court, his shoulders slumped, eyes glazed, his skin paler than the drab lighting could shade. He looked up as Ediard walked in. His expression of misery slowly changed, as if his facial muscles were regaining strength, hardening his cheeks and jaw into a look of pure fury. Ediard met it without flinching as the inspector demanded to know about higher-than-normal expenditure on smoked toco nuts on the 6th Thursday of June 2 years ago. Boate never shifted his gaze from Ediard while his clerk struggled to produce receipts for the jars. In the end, it was Ediard who looked away first. He could barely believe it, but he was close to feeling sorry for Boate. Theirs was an epic struggle for the soul of an entire city. It should be fought out there on the streets and along the canals. Followers slugging it out with fists and third hands, while their political masters plotted and schemed in council. Not this. This was inhuman. And I did it to him. Ediard bowed his head to look at his boots. Every inch, the little boy at the back of the class struggling not to giggle. He hurried out of the finance court, then stopped in the cloister and laughed out loud. Clerks in their drab, claret and olive green waistcoats stared at him disapprovingly. Sorry, Ediard said to them and their guild in general. He made an effort to compose himself, then walked on toward Center Circle Canal. He could do that. He could leave the court after a good laugh. Good gloat, if I'm honest. Boate couldn't. Boate had to stay there for 6 hours every day, as he had done for 10 days now, and the investigation was likely to last another 8 days at least, Ediard had been told. If only we could do this to each of the 100. We'd have broken them by now. We wouldn't need banishment. They'd have fled screaming through the city gates long ago. But this kind of financial scrutiny was reserved for the larger city businesses that were constantly cheating taxes. The chief constable had to press hard with the inspector general for an inspector to launch his formal examination of Boate's accounts. It had used up a great deal of time and cost far more than it would ever produce in fines. Worst of all, the clerk still hadn't found any tangible link between Boate and Ranelagh's family. Of course, that didn't really matter. He was just using the tax investigation as a major irritant against Boate, while the Jeevans constables built up the 100 list. But a proven link would have been nice. Ediard left the merged domes of the Parliament building behind and crossed over the delicate white wire bridge of Center Circle Canal. The patch of land ringed by the little canal was too small to rate as a district. People just called it Ra's Garden, a small green oasis in the middle of government's commotion. He walked along simple paths lined by tall, perfectly shaped flame yews. Roses were throwing out their first blossoms of the season, releasing a gentle scent into the still air. Several freshwater ponds were joined together by small streams, crossed by small brick humpback bridges. As he went across them, he could see big emerald and scarlet fish gliding around smoothly. They seemed to regard him slyly as he went by. On the other side of Ra's garden, the rear of the orchard palace rose before him, higher than any of the domes behind.
Captain LaRose was waiting for him at the bottom of the broad symmetrical perron that led up into the palace. Ediard straightened his dress jacket, though it was something of a lost cause beside the captain's ceremonial uniform.
Water Walker.
Just you today, Captain.
Fried sour, old chap. Inside the palace I am naught but a humble guide.
Then guide me in, please.
They ascended the three levels of the perron and went in through a high arching door. Five long cloisters led away from the hallway.
Congratulations, by the way, LaRose said. Christabel's a fine catch.
Thank you.
I met her myself a few times. Obviously, I didn't make much of an impression.
Ediard thought it best to let that one slide past.
Did you really farsight Sergeant Che's cell?
Yes.
Ediard had finally learned to stop sighing as he answered that question 20 times a day. It was disrespectful.
That must put life into perspective, eh?
Death isn't quite so frightening, but that doesn't mean that life shouldn't be celebrated.
You are an extraordinary fellow, the captain declared as they emerged into Malford Hall.
Ediard could well imagine the captain reading A Gentleman's Guide to Marriage and hanging off every word. They passed into the Liliella Hall, where Ediard stopped to regard the ceiling with the same astonishment as the first time he'd seen the images in Malford Hall. The storm swirled silently above him. Light flickered all around, casting strange angled shadows as lightning bolts zipped through the clouds. Then Alucard slipped through a breach in the scudding clouds, a smooth black ball of a world, threaded with hundreds of glowing red lines as vast rivers of lava surged along the surface.
I never knew this was here,
an enchanted Ediard said, craning his neck as he tried to see the entire ceiling at once.
Can you see all of Gaikon's bracelet?
You know your astronomy.
Some of it.
We had a very old telescope in the guild hall where I grew up. My master enjoyed watching the skies. He always said he was trying to see if another ship was on its way to Quarantia. I think he was actually watching for Skylords.
Indeed. Well, if you wait long enough, you'll see all the worlds in the bracelet.
Cloud surged back across Alucard. Ediard would have loved to linger. The bracelet was always his favorite feature in the night sky, five small planets rotating around each other, orbiting further out from the sun than Quarantia itself. The ancient telescope had never shown him Alucard in such detail. He wondered how Vili would look in here, or the Mars twins. LaRose led him through into the series of splendid chambers that made up the mayor's private rooms. Owen was waiting in the oval sanctum, sitting behind the largest desk Ediard had ever seen. He wondered what on Quarantia could be in all the drawers, but held back from probing with his farsight.
Water Walker, Owen said with a genuine smile, my full and sincere congratulations on this day. You're a very lucky man.
Thank you, sir. It appeared the whole city was pleased for him and Christabel. Owen waited until LaRose left.
First off, allow me to apologize profusely for the episode in Erie.
Sir?
Those lady-damned pistols. My guild has held them in safekeeping for over 1,000 years. They are perhaps our most closely guarded secret. How they came to be removed is still a mystery. Even if you manage to get them out of the vault, there are guards, locks. It should be impossible. It has been impossible until now.
Do you know who was responsible?
Ronark and Doral had interrogated all the gang members they'd apprehended that night, but they were nothing more than couriers. No one knew the actual source of the guns, the man who was offering them for sale.
We think we've identified the principal thief, Owen said, though he has, of course, conveniently vanished. I'm shamed to say he was one of my guild's senior journeymen, a man called Argian.
I don't recall the name.
Studious man, destined to be a master, though perhaps not to sit on the guild council itself.
Here,
Owen gifted his image. Ediard was quite proud of the way he held his composure, shield firm, no sense of surprise leaking out. Argian was the man he was currently holding in the underground cell.
I'll let the constable stations know. The patrols can watch for him.
Good man, though I suspect he's left the city. Betraying us in such a despicable fashion carries a heavy penalty. He must have known that.
I hope they paid him well.
Yes, sir. Ediard was desperately trying to work out connections.
It was inevitable that the family agents would have someone inside the Weapons Guild, and probably every other guild come to that. It would be easy now to find Argyon's family, who would never acknowledge any association, especially as they would know he was being held by the Waterwalker.
But let us ignore that today, Owen said. This is your day, yes. A time to be joyful.
Ediard forced a grin.
Don't worry, Waterwalker. This next part is just a formality. You know it's considered bad form to vote against the Consent Act. We're long past such barbarity.
Thank you, sir.
It will be my pleasure to allow Julin to introduce it. So, are you ready?
I think so.
Well, I am. You and Christabel will make a fine couple. And don't repeat this, but it never hurts to shake things up a bit. If you ask me, the grand families are becoming somewhat jaded these days. Someone like you in their ranks is just what they need.